So thanks everybody for coming along. I will say apologetically, but thank you. The speakers did not forcefully request you to come up front into the center. That was my handler, if she can raise her hand and wave. Yep, she's back there. But I appreciate it. We're gonna leave some room at the end because I know there's a lot of stuff that you can ask around what we've done with this, and we'll go. So my name is Lyle Dodge. Nice to meet you. Hari?
Hi. I'm a senior developer in the supply chain engineering group.
For context, I work for the IT showcase at Microsoft. My day job consists of talking to the software engineers inside of core services engineering. That is formerly Microsoft IT. We're all under one person now, Kurt Delbene. He's the person that used to run Office, left, fixed Azure Gov, came back, and now is in charge of essentially redoing what we do to run our line of business operations at Microsoft. So there's a talk that Kurt's doing tomorrow that I highly suggest you go to. There's a lot of thought leadership around taking an enterprise like Microsoft and completely redoing how we do customer 360 analytics, all the other things. Hari is from our devices supply chain, and this is one of the great examples of an internal line of business application team that's frankly taken something that runs this scale. So devices supply chain, does anybody have any inkling of what that means? What is a devices supply chain? Spit out some words. What does that mean? What? Factories. Oh my God, you guys are almost dead. Logistics, thank you.
Xbox,
yep. So think of anything that Microsoft produces, manufactures, first party, third party, sells in one of our universal stores online, a partner store in the US, Canada, Europe, and then everything that happens in between there. So logistics, distribution, receiving, accounts receivable, accounts payable. Somebody scans a pallet to receive a shipment. That goes into your backend SAP system, says, yes, I actually did receive those. So maybe I should send you the money for that. Let's deduct them from inventory, all those kind of fun things. Well, there's a lot of stuff you guys do. So you used to have this on-premise. What kind of footprint did you have running that?
So we had a pretty large-scale BizTalk server platform, I'd say. We had close to around 80 servers, I would say, and we were kind of trading around 3 million transactions per day. So, and we were having all the transactions right from, you know, all the kind of we listed through from sourcing to planning to fulfillment to order management to logistics, returns, everything in that single hub. So that was a pretty large scale we were dealing with, and obviously it was on-premise, so we had to deal with a lot of, installation, OS installation, patching, and constant monitoring of the services. So we had a pretty large team from a support standpoint we needed, really.
Yep. And so another slide. This is kind of what some of the words that people said. This is everything that the team has to deal with. So this is another great question. So how big was the team before that, including patching people, service engineers, service operations?
I would say
this is off script, so we're going to see some fun stuff today.
Yeah, so I think apart from the development team, which pretty much has remained the same, I would say, we had a pretty large support team dedicated for, handling, restarting services to, as simple as restarting services to, patching and all that. So we had close to around more than certainly 50, I would say.
Okay.
I mean, that includes the support, first line support, second line support, pretty dedicated team for handling the infrastructure.
Okay. So let's see if this is in, can we tweak the audio a little bit? I'm just getting some bounce feedback, thanks. So what this looks like in the Azure platform, you guys are using API apps, functions, logic apps in the tiers that talk to customers. You're using Service Bus, Event Hub, and Event Grid. So Service Bus here is kind of like your BizTalk message box, right? So when stuff hits that, you're transactionally solid.
That's right. So we are kind of, so what we did is, when we came from the BizTalk platform, we obviously had some, a little bit of services to on-premise, but however, BizTalk was a primary one. So the thing that we were kind of looking is, hey, can I go ahead and do the patterns that we have in BizTalk platform, can we do with it? And really, that's where the Service Bus, along with Logic Apps, as well as Function App, really, we were able to pretty much mimic every pattern that was available in BizTalk out of box, we were able to do with these components.
Mm-hmm. And so let's look at what that means. And so we all love architecture diagrams, and then don't worry, It's 4:30, 4:40. I know you guys are probably like, please don't show me PowerPoint slides. Hey, I see people trying to say, take pictures. Ready? Okay, go ahead, try now. Okay, try now. Let's have some fun in Q&A. So this is really what the team is doing. So for the ingestion layer, we have API management. Everything's secured by Azure Active Directory. There's some links in the back of this that will point you to walk through demos of this from the Docs platform that I think would highly suggest you follow. Everything is goes over Azure Traffic Manager, so you guys have, which policy do you have on Traffic Manager for your stuff?
We have the weighted.
Okay, weighted. So you guys have stuff in East-West US today, and then you have replicas of certain things in East-West US. So has everybody had enough slides? So Hari's birthday was Saturday.
So, and his?
My birthday was yesterday. We found out the other day we were born on the same year, but on the opposite sides of the world. And so I asked Hari, I said, hey, Hari, guess what I want for my birthday? His demo's not to blow up. So let's all, okay, done with PowerPoint. So let's go look at Azure Active Directory API Management API apps and actually look at what the team has done on this. So let me walk over, hit the little button.
All right, so I think so all these services are really integrated through Active Directory. So let's have a quick brief walkthrough of, I know most of the guys, I think for folks who would be using Active Directory, just curious, how many folks are really using Active Directory?
That's Azure everybody. Active Directory, I think a lot of them are probably using, Active.
All right, so let's go here. So what I've done here is created a...
So if you're fast enough, Hari is bringing up all of our UAT pre-prod environments. So let's see who's fast enough to pull a key and do something.
This one is dummy. So
okay.
All right. So from Active Directory standpoint, just to get in the same page for everybody. So you have the when you have an application that is hosted on Azure and you want to have the authentication to that through Active Directory, you'd first create an application for that, let's say a web app. In this case, for example, I create a Fabricam supply chain service, right, which is associated with the web app that we're going to look into. So in this case, I'll go ahead and create, this is the manifest available within the application. So what I've done is a couple of roles I would like to give into the web app with respect to read permission, write permission, or maybe admin permission. And I can give more than one service I can configure in this particular manifest for this particular application, which means that you can have multiple services, multiple web apps associated with this particular application in Azure Active Directory.
So this is the essentially the service AAD application that's going to run what we saw up there. My API apps are going to run essentially under this.
Right.
And then on the right side here, you're defining all the different kinds of roles that your code in the API apps will use to look up, hey, this my caller, what can they do, what can't they do?
Yep. So that's the first step. Now the second step is for every tenant, so for example, a partner, B2B partner, they want to call the web API, they need to be onboarded as a tenant. So we'll create an application for this particular tenant. So I'll go ahead and search for that tenant as well. So I created Contoso. I guess everybody's used to these partners, Fabricam and Contoso. So here I would go ahead and go to these settings, and I'll give the required permission. So in this case, I want to give a permission for the Contoso application onto the Fabricam service application. So go ahead and select the API. Once I've selected, the roles that are associated with that particular service application will pop up. So over here, I'll give these. And once I've done that, I have to do one more step, and that is I have to do grant permissions.
So essentially for every partner, now I know back when you were in BizTalk days, how long would it typically take, let's say you were using, the supply chain was using FedEx, UPS, and you wanted to order onboard like DHL. How long did it take you guys to onboard? A couple days?
So in the BizTalk platform, obviously, we are using the AS2 kind of transports, mm-hmm. which are kind of a little bit, I would say, out of date. And it used to even take, you know, a couple of weeks to even get things right. So getting through Azure Active Directory, I think we had pretty much done in a, you know, couple of minutes, really. Just 5 minutes to really provision it, and we're bam, done. Yep. And once they come to the developer portal, they can test it by themselves.
So for each partner that's coming on, maybe a new logistics partner in a new region, right, create an AD app for them that's tied to their AD tenant. Yep. You're done.
Right. And we still have, through Logic Apps, we still have the AS2 connection. That's still better, though. However, what was the experience that was an on-premise?
Okay.
So we saw that we created the service application. We saw the client application. Now, if I want to go ahead and just test that out, so I want to go ahead and get the key for this particular client application. So I'll go ahead and get a key from here. So let's say client key. And I'm going to give a duration. And one thing about the way that we are trying to do here is we're trying to use the same client ID in secret for multiple services so that when the partner comes in, the partner might need to access multiple services. So we use the same credential to access multiple services so that it's seamless experience for the partner when they're onboarding. So in this case, I'll take this particular key and go over here and generate it. See, I didn't copy it properly. Give me a second.
Loki is pissed.
Sorry, somebody said that.
You have a carriage return.
Oh, you have a carriage return after equals.
Oh, thank you. Sure. Give me a second.
My God, your eyes are good.
You know what, I need to do this. Yeah, it's a, I'm encoding that into.
Oh. My handler's looking at me. Oh, are you saying louder, or we should make it bigger? Oh, we should make the text larger.
Client secret.
We will work on that.
I'm sorry, where?
SQL's in.
Yeah, the SQL. Yeah, that doesn't take in this format, so let me see.
Yeah.
It's not taking that. One second.
You want it?
Let me just use the other previous one, maybe generate another one, let's see. Great. I'm sorry.
Oh, he said sometimes when you get a key, it's got a forward slash.
Let's see.
Okay, you want to just control Z back?
Yeah, I'm just thinking that. All right, that's ready.
Okay.
All right, I'm just going to do a couple of control. Just use the previous one, which was working. All right. So I'm going to use this bearer token. So quickly.
Let's give Hari a hand. Thank you. Now we're ready to go.
All right, so I'm going to use that particular.
So wait, so what did you do there? You went and sent in a request to AAD,
yeah,
and got your claim. Your authentication token.
I got the access token. Okay. Now, we're going to look into in terms of what's really inside that access token, right? So I'm going to push that into this decryptor. So here, if you see, it's kind of decrypted that, and these are the roles that were provided as part of that application. So once we get these within this, now let's look at in terms of how does the API app or the web app really process these.
So I'm a customer. I'm FedEx, DHL, UPS. I went, made an automated call to AAD, put my credentials in, got a JDBT token back. Now I'm going to turn around, and we're going to show how does the code actually use those claims? Yeah.
All right, the first thing is, let's look at it here. So the control rail comes over to the operations that's defined within the API, right? And we, you know, kind of decorate it with the authorize attribute. And what the authorize attribute really gives us, it gives the claims principle. And once you get that, what we are doing is we are passing that to another attribute, which is a kind of a custom attribute, which will go ahead and look into in terms of equating that what claims are configured for this particular operation, what's allowed, and what is really coming in the claims principle from the AD.
Okay. So authorize, forced, looking at the web config, how it's set up,
right.
Force AD auth. Your custom authenticate says only people that have AD admin or AD.write in that manifest and they've been given access to that can do it.
Right. So in this case, when the application starts up, so we are using an OWIN authentication pipeline, Open Web Interface for .NET. So we are, when the service is really starting up, so we are get that and we pass on the AD audience and AD tenant, which is configured in the service. So if I go here, over here, so we're given the AD tenant as well as the AD audience over here. And also what we have done is kind of a mapping that what you saw in the controller AD.read is mapped to the role that is specific to this particular service, which we mapped in the original client tenant application. So that we have mapped it here. So what goes on here is really we are matching that and checking that in the authentication. So I'll quickly show that as well. So here, so really what we are doing is reading that from the configuration file and then matching it in terms of what is coming in the claims principle and checking that, hey, is this really present in that claim principle or not?
So this is just some code that you wrote, and then the config is actually just you guys storing some key value pairs somewhere, so that way when the claims authentication fires and you're actually iterating through the claims, right. You have some reusability across all of your APIs.
That's right. So what we have done is effectively we have created a set of libraries and also a base controller, which can be called in from the primary service, the multiple service controllers we have. So what it kind of gives us, we kind of went through a process of putting a pattern of kind of a combination of repository pattern as well as lazy initialization as well, and a singleton pattern for the multiple services that we are accessing. So for example, we are accessing DocumentDB, and we are accessing ServiceBus, Blob. So we created the libraries for that, and that we are reusing across multiple components. Okay. So if you look at here, let's go and look at here. So in this case, we are doing a lazy initialization to make sure that the object is really being used only when it's when the call comes in. So we're creating a wrapper on top of the APIs that's available. And for DocumentDB, we are creating stored procedures, and we are executing from the .NET code.
Okay. So we've looked through kind of what happened on the left side. Now, I know when you go to create an API management artifact in the Azure portal, like default, the products come through as developer, admin, the products. Can we go actually bring up the products that you guys have in your environment? Because I think seeing how products and APIs are created and then the mapping between those in the context of, I think everybody understands if I buy something from a website, how does it get to me, or if the website needs to restock?
Yeah. So there's the APIM, and previously we used to have we still have it, that portal. Many of the functionalities from a publisher standpoint or admin standpoint are now moved into the portal. So I think at some point, the other portal, that previous portal, would be only for developer experience. So if you're going into the publisher view, what you can really do here is you can actually provision users. Now the users can be provisioned with different authentication mechanisms. And for example, in this case, I've just created a Rob, user in this case with my email ID. And what it would give me is a user credential and a user object, which I can associate for access to multiple services and multiple products.
Okay.
So I go here and so in this case, I can add a subscription. So I already have some products out there. So let's say logistics, and I'll select that. And I'll give it a name. And I think then I can get a key for that, and I can call this particular service.
So this is, if I've got a partner, they've onboarded a developer from that partner, you've now essentially, you're mocking you right there, your Hotmail.
Yeah.
Everybody go try and hack it. Sorry.
I created that today.
Oh, you created it today? Okay. So that's a partner. They've got their API key. So now they've got the API ID. They've got their JWT token. Now they can actually go call stuff.
Right. So at this point, the user is effectively provisioned onto the application API gateway. Mm-hmm. So at this point, you know, they can go and, you know, as a developer, they can go and experience in terms of look at what is the catalog of services that is available. How can I go and connect to it? How can I go and test it out? So before that, let's have a quick, from a publisher standpoint, let's look at it from the products and API standpoint. So what you see here is the bunch of APIs that we defined. And let this come up. So in this case, a bunch of APIs are there. And you can define the operations on top of it. And in this case, for example, it's the API is really calling the ATM at the back end.
Delivery order change, what's that delivery?
It's primarily the delivery orders are nothing but fulfillment orders. So okay. When we have to tell to the warehouse telling that, hey, go ahead and ship this particular pallet or parcel to a customer, you know, we place a fulfillment order. And okay. We do changes on top of it. So that's the service, really.
Okay. Yeah.
So at this point, you can create the backend, you know, set the backend endpoint and create policies. So policies are effectively, if you do want to do some kind of pre-processing and post-processing before and after the request comes to the API management gateway, that's what the policies are for. Yeah. So for example, we integrate with SAP heavily. So what we do is SAP sends us through HTTP, they send us XML, IDOC, mm-hmm. and we convert that to JSON. So the conversion from XML to JSON, we do that in the API management gateway so that from a service standpoint, we kind of holistically keep it only JSON-based.
Okay.
So that's the API definition that we have created over here. So multiple services over here. And once these services are created, they can be grouped under products. So from a supply chain standpoint, you would like to know, you know, you want to keep the grouping of services as, you know, based upon the supply chain function, right? So for example, you have fulfillment, you have logistics, you want to group the APIs according to that, and you might put them across multiple services too. So that's what the products are for. So it helps in the service cataloging effectively. So let's quickly go here and look through.
You can also like test it out, right? So you can actually send in a test message.
Yes. So let's look at what from a developer experience, what's the experience out here. So as a developer, the access that we saw, I have it over here. So I can go here and look at the products, and I can get the corresponding APIs underneath that. So effectively, this will give me in terms of the ability to go ahead and test it out. And you know, I'm actually hitting the APIs behind that. So from a developer onboarding experience becomes really pretty easy and smooth. So whatever experience we previously had in the on-premise, we didn't have the ability to go ahead and test it out from partner. It was a cumbersome one. Now it's really once you provision them, it's pretty much easy to do that. So at this point, do we want to test it out or?
Yeah, let's get it set up.
All right. So let me go here. And one thing to show, one more thing I'll show here. So let me go to the publisher portal. So there are two keys effectively. One is an APIM key, right, which authorizes on the API management gateway itself, mm-hmm. right? And then you have the AD, of course, which is to the backend, right? So at this point, you would like to generate that APIM key for this particular user. And that's what we kind of saw in when we provisioned the user. You can generate the key for the API management gateway itself.
Okay.
So once you get that key, you can go ahead and set up, let me go here and quickly. So here you can actually create an authorization server, which means that you can give the credentials of the AD, so that because the call really comes to the API management gateway in this particular point, and as a user, you're not really entering any AD credential. Right, so you want to give the AD credential as well to make sure that the authentication and authorization happens at the back end. So you create the authorization server, and then I can go here and select that authorization server over here. So this will generate a bearer token over here, and the bearer token is put over here.
Right? Okay.
So I can go ahead and submit a message now. So from the user standpoint, it's pretty seamless that he goes and submits test data, and you know he can set it out. So okay. This is one.
So at this point, you've sent something in, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's.
Let me use a new one as well. Give me a second. I just want to make sure that I'm using a new correlation ID.
So this correlation ID is something that is sent in from the partner when they're making the call, right?
That's right. Okay. So it helps in the end-to-end tracking of the transactions across the different components that we have.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So what you've done is effectively gone to AAD, grabbed a token, gone to APIM, grabbed a secret, or grabbed a client ID. Made now when you went and actually hit send, you sent that in, hit Azure Traffic Manager, probably went to West, I'm assuming at this point.
I went to East.
Oh, went to East, okay, cool. Then your API code actually took that message, took the metadata off, put it into
the service bus.
Into the service bus
queue. It put the payload in the blob.
Yep, so that's one of the cool things here is you don't put the whole message into service bus. You actually split the message off into blobs, and you only do metadata into your system.
And the primary reason is that we are dealing with pretty large messages, B2B messages, which are pretty large in terms of especially a containment could really span out to even MB sometimes. Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure that service bus handles only up to 256 KB, right? So mm-hmm. we put the metadata there and the actual full payload into the blob.
Okay. And so this is really cool. The second demo that we're going to see is really how you've taken metadata and basically reproduced BizTalk BAM in the cloud.
Right.
So that comes, you go back, send a message back to the consumer. Then you have functions, logic apps that pick up the message from service bus, pick up the metadata payload from mm-hmm. service bus, do what it needs to, do some processing, put it into Cosmos, and then either the customer comes back as part of step 10, goes and pulls some data, or you may push some data back.
That's right. So can you just go back?
Yep.
So we kind of can't. Yeah, so.
Okay, people are leaving. Let's have everybody else stay till 6:30, right?
So the pattern that we are trying to try to put it here is kind of a CQRS pattern, a command query. So what we are trying to do is a partner goes ahead and posts a particular command with respect to a transaction, right? And the same partner could come back and query what is the status of the transaction, or it could be some other partner who can come and query. And that's where we're using Cosmos DB for querying the transaction, making GET operations.
Okay. So let's go. You already posted the message, right?
Yes.
So what does that actually look like? Like, did logic apps run on it, or what?
That's right. So we had, it's refreshing here. So the logic apps really shows the runs that have really happened. It gives the ability to see that, hey, these are the runs that happened, and it can go in terms of, hey, what is the flow of the transaction that happened within the logic app? Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much visible here. So it's refreshing. Let me go back and come back here. All right, so we saw the transaction that came through. Looks like it's obviously submitted two transactions, right? The one previous one and the new one. So I'll go here and quickly check in terms of what is the flow that happened within the logic app. And that gives me a visualization in terms of really how the code really executed within logic app. And at this point, what you effectively see is that the transaction picked up from a service bus, the metadata, right? And then you would effectively get the actual payload from the blob, right? And then you compose the metadata for the Cosmos DB and insert that. And then you're going to do a translation with respect to what is needed for SAP. So we, in this case, we're sending the transaction to SAP. We are transforming that from the JSON to a SAP IDOC and sending to an endpoint of SAP, which is behind an APIM gateway. And once we are done, we want to check that, hey, what is the status of the transaction, and want to record that in Cosmos DB as well to say that this transaction was complete from SAP, I got a response back, and everything is good.
Okay, so that right there, that's, why do you have a primary and secondary connection?
So that's primarily the, so if it's in Logic App, really, Logic App by itself gives a huge throughput, and each connector that we have in Logic App has its own throughput. Which means, for example, a service bus connector might have a very high throughput, let's say 3,000 transactions per second, while another connector might not have that much throughput. So it kind of creates an impedance mismatch, right? Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure that I don't fail the entire logic app flow just because I have this particular connector downstream connector or an application downstream was not able to handle it. Mm-hmm. So by duplicating that, it gives the kind of double or triple the number of times you're kind of pasting within the scope of one logic app run.
Okay. So you may have a failure in that first one, but it's going to quickly flop over to the second one, which
That's
can
right.
handle that alleviate it.
Okay. That's right. All right. So in this case, so this is all executed. And at this point, I'm going to go ahead and just check the transaction, what happened. And so let me pick up this guy. So everything is writing to AI. So one thing about the Logic App is also writing to AI at this point, and all the transactions were from Logic App to APA App, and in fact, some of the partner transactions are also coming over here. We look into it, how we're kind of enriching the telemetry.
Okay.
Right. So at this point, we can look into the details of the transaction. We have some custom data out there, which is kind of the business context of the transaction, which we're capturing.
So because you're not sending the full payload to App Insights, you're sending the metadata, but you have custom dimensions.
Right.
So this is where you've gone and enriched.
That's right.
Some stuff.
That's right.
So talk us through that.
Okay. So I think we have to switch to this.
Oh, yeah.
Slide.
Yeah, sure. This one to talk through.
Okay. So what we are kind of doing here is we are pumping all the telemetry events, kind of a metadata event, which is just the correlation ID, in fact, what we saw earlier, that we are moving to putting into Event Hub. And from Event Hub, I think
I'm going to give you this because I totally just screwed him up and like skipped ahead six slides to see if he could do it. So here's what happens. Can you walk us through? So I think this is a really cool thing that I've seen other teams, they use App Insights and they use Log Analytics. Your team essentially said, everything that happens in the platform, I'm going to strip my metadata packet and put that all into Event Hubs. And then you're going to go have functions go grab that and do what with it?
So it kind of does the enrichment. So the key thing is that, right, in the different components of within the architecture, you might have a particular call or a particular method which might not have context with respect to the business data. However, when you query the data in the AI, you would query it by an order number or a correlation ID, for example. But usually from a business context, you'll come with a PO number or a delivery order number, right? So you want to make sure that every event that is logged from each and every component in the architecture gets enriched with the business data. So in this case, what you're doing is putting the metadata into Event Hub, which is a very light payload, and then which is referencing the payload in the blob. So from there, from the Event Hub, then we are having, you know, and function app gets triggered, which picks up the payload from the blob, as well as applies a template that is specific to this particular service. So for example, we have a JSON template which says, hey, you know what, this is the JPath, go ahead and fetch this particular data from the payload and enrich it in the overall telemetry event. And once we get that, we push it to the application insights. And once it goes to application insights, we run Power BI, as well as we pump it to log analytics, as well as, you know, we are trying to build a bot on top of it where, you know, we can have kind of a more intelligent data with handling with respect to the business information that we are seeking.
Okay, so now that I've totally screwed up your flow, let's go look at some of this stuff.
So one thing is about AI is, of course, you can do a technical telemetry, right? And in this case, if I run this, it'll get in terms of what is the request and how much time from a percentile standpoint I got it. And at the same time, I can run a business query, which tells me, hey, where is my shipments coming from? Let's say I shipment from, you know, we have multiple locations of shipment, and as well as they're going to multiple locations with respect to from a ship to standpoints. So I'll run this and.
So this also means that the Power BI reports that look at your App Insights data, one of your business users can say, hey, show me what happened with this PO number, even though what flew through essentially your BizTalk in the cloud system only had correlation IDs and other numbers, not a PO insight.
That's right.
And so most of the time, our customers and some of our internal teams would go, okay, well, that's in this system, this system, this system. Let's go build a Power BI that bridges like 5 or 10 databases.
Right.
And you've just put it right in the native App Insights.
Right. And I can join even if my application insights for different services might be different, I can join them together to get the kind of a business context. I can get it and give it to the user. Mm-hmm. And from Power BI, we are pulling this application insight data, and then we are running, you know, reports on top of it. And as well as from application insight, I can go and generate these charts as well, which the business needs. All right. And so let's switch back to, I think, the security and storage.
Yep. So I'm going to walk it back because I totally mess with Hari. It's my birthday. I'm allowed, right? Oh, yeah, 7. I think 6. No, 6. You got it. Okay, so on this diagram here, we kind of talked about a bunch of stuff here. We talked about this. We showed that. But you've got this blob and this blob. So what are you guys doing? I know when you first started, Key Vault and the other stuff was, you could still do everything, but it was a little harder. So what are you doing now?
So I think if you remember the web config that we previously saw, effectively what we we created an application for the Key Vault, and then we provisioned this particular web application to access the Key Vault. We created another, an application for this web application. And effectively what we had to do is we had to give the AD client and secret to access a token, get a token, and then call the Key Vault's application, right? Now, that's kind of a cumbersome process if you look at it, because we had to also kind of make it securely keep it. So we had to kind of encrypt it with a certificate and have the certificate. It was really a cumbersome process to have it. Mm-hmm. Now, what this gives is the MSI feature, which is the managed services identity. So if you go to the next one. So what it does, it's kind of a one step really, or probably I'll say three steps effectively, where you kind of provision the managed service identity for the, within the key vault, you go ahead and give the principal of that application, which is, for example, a function app, right? So, and we will probably switch it. I think that'll be easier.
Everybody's awake. I might make him play a game in a few minutes anyway.
All right, so let's go to a key vault and look into it. All right, so here I can go ahead and in the access policies, I can add another application principle, and I can, that provisions that particular application. So what it kind of does, it's kind of a quasi or a proxy application it creates, or for AD application it creates, and gives that access. So this is from the key vault standpoint, I have given a provision to a service principle. And now I would need to go ahead and in the application itself. So let's say, for example, I have a function app, right? So let's get a function app over here. And I would go to the platform features. And then I have the managed service identity. And here, I'll just go ahead and save it on, right? These are the real two steps from a portal standpoint. And then I would go to the code. And really, these are the two lines of code that I effectively have with respect to authenticating it. Mm-hmm. And then, I can get the secret from the key vault by giving the particular key, and I'm done. So, and we have created this library, which gets effectively used in multiple other libraries or services. And, it's pretty seamless from that standpoint. And what it helps us really, even from a functional test standpoint, when we are doing a CI/CD kind of scenario, it's much more easier to integrate with the MSI than before what we had.
Okay, cool. And so the other thing that we had talked about that we saw in our diagram but didn't quite show was the fact that you guys are using Cosmos DB for most of your backend.
Right.
So what are the features that you're using out of that?
So when we went for Cosmos DB, one thing we wanted to make sure that we are utilizing it the right way, right? And Cosmos DB really works if you have a large volume. It's really good that you can keep the partition at a specific correlation ID or a particular ID level that really scales. Mm-hmm. However, if that's not the case, you might not want to partition it, for every correlation ID, for example, right? So what we kind of wanted, had the requirement is we wanted to segregate it based upon the tenant. So what we created is kind of we didn't effectively create any partition. It's a single partition. Because what's the catch of having multiple partition is your overall throughput gets, distributed across a partition. So in specific scenarios, we don't have that much volume enough to really, distribute it across different tenants.
It's like a trading partner that doesn't hit you very often.
Correct, exactly. So we want to make sure that we optimally use the throughput in a particular partition. So we created logical partitions within a single partition, for which is the logical partitions with respect to a partner. So for example, partner one, partner two, like that. We create logical partitions, but effectively they are really in a single physical partition.
Okay.
So that helps from a throughput standpoint. So that's from a Cosmos DB, as a transaction store. Mm. Now, second thing is we are using it from an eventing system, where we want to make sure that there are partners, right, who may not really want to do a come and get transaction. We want to do an eventing. They have a requirement to do a post, right? In that particular case, we want to have the trigger when really there's an update or a create that happens within the Cosmos DB, and we trigger signal to the partner. And that's where we are using the change feature of Cosmos DB. And that's what you see here is the persistent event store of Cosmos DB that triggers it. And that triggers a function app and sends it to a particular subscriber.
Okay.
And within this, you have different ways of doing it. So I think let's switch it. I think that'll be easier. So effectively, what you see here, let's go to that. All right. So in the change feed, really, what happens is you keep a lease of, in terms of the, the processes that are running and querying the feed. You need to keep a lease in terms of kind of it's a semaphore, effectively, right? To make sure that I'm the one who's reading it, the data, and nobody else can get the lock on it. Okay. Before I mention this, there are two ways to again do it. The change feed. One is an out-of-box way where the functions are there. So let me go to the functions and show you quickly that how do you do out of box. Give me a second here. So what we are, while it's coming up, so one way is the function app, which gives the out-of-box binding. And the second way is you use a SQL SDK that's available. And you can kind of write your own code. And you can pull it through a trigger. So the function app works on a trigger. And this one is more of a timer-based one. And you effectively get a checkpoint for based upon the particular partition key. So the reason for using the SQL SDK is that you want more control in terms of I want to have the trigger based on a specific partition. In that particular case, you'll use a SQL SDK because the out-of-box one doesn't give you the provision, at least as of yet.
And so you're using it that way to say, essentially, because you had a logical partition for your partner.
Yes.
OK.
So partner one is, for example, a larger volume. But that particular partner comes and does a get. You don't want to do a change feed for that particular partner and try to increase the throughput in your system, right, from a function app standpoint. Yeah. I want a specific partner. Pull that particular partition and get the data, okay. Right? So you get a checkpoint effectively, which you kind of maintain. And then you go ahead and replace the lease that we saw. The lease is basically a document DB document, which you kind of replace in that part, you do a replace. So whenever you have to do an update in document DB, effectively you are kind of replacing that document.
Okay.
So that's what we are doing with respect to the lease. We are replacing the lease in that particular collection. And maintaining the lease with respect to which particular process, because you can have more than one process which is pulling that particular document DB.
Okay.
Okay. And so if I go over here and quickly look here, I should have already got. So from the function app, effectively, I'm pumping it to a service bus, and this is really coming from the function app.
Okay.
And I was about to show the function app. Let me quickly show that. But it's taking a lot of time, I guess. Okay.
We can get that.
Okay.
So the next thing I think we really want to show is really the, you can show it? You want to show it?
What's
it? You want to show that one?
Yeah, I think.
Okay. Let's. So this is the built-in binding.
The built-in binding is this one. So where you effectively give the, so in this case, I'm putting it to blob for the built-in one. And for the code, the custom one, I'm effectively putting that into a service bus. And that's the service bus is, again, through the code, not through the binding. But.
OK. So now we showed a bunch of stuff. I want to see like what you guys have done on App Insights and Log Analytics, because I think part of having BizTalk is having the rich telemetry.
Yeah.
So
we are using Log Analytics, especially from a technical telemetry standpoint, and triggering alerts out of it. So what effectively all the events that really go from Logic App to Function App to API apps, all of them go into Log Analytics. And from there, we are effectively generating the charts which are with respect to the service health and getting the alerts on top of it. Hey, the Logic App is down, or this particular region is down. We're getting alerts out of that. So in this case, I'll go to the particular service that we were looking into. Do you change? Oh, that's a delivery order.
And so whereas before you had on-premise, you had essentially your same five software engineers and other teams handling stuff, It's still your same five software engineers. Do you still have anybody else dealing with this, or is this
no.
all go
so,
to you?
So that's the biggest transition. I think we are totally moved into a DevOps model where it's beyond DevOps model, I would say, where we, you know, developers are handling the production in and day in, day out. And the really the differentiation that has happened is we really spend very less time in production. And frankly, I mean, this week I'm kind of one of the primary on call. And,
oh, you're on call right now.
Yeah. So, nice. So really, I think we can focus more on the things that matter. I think that's really helping. And with respect to, you know, we don't have to spend time in terms of, hey, you know what, restart this particular service. You know, go and do this patch. None of them, I think, we have to do now. It's pretty seamless from that standpoint, as long as we are designing it the right way, we are putting the resiliency in the design, we are having automatic retries, you know, transient retries, all that good things that you have. And then you put the right alerts to make sure that you're getting the call at the right time.
Okay. So I'm like a slide away from Q&A. You're going to be the first one.
Can you give a mic?
Do you execute infrastructure as code approach? Is that what you said? There's a mic right there. We'll let you ask. This is the only question before the Q&A slide.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm saying go for it.
I mean, you also described your infrastructure as a code in this example. Because it looks like quite complex one, so if you drop something or something.
Yeah. So can you bring up your CI/CD pipeline that you...
Okay.
So everything that you guys check in goes through and gets deployed via your CI/CD pipeline. So you guys don't actually go do any of this manually.
That's right. So we pretty much have these, you know, the tasks. So let's see, go here.
Oh, sure. Yeah, where's the full pipeline list?
Oh, why is this not coming up? Wait.
Just go up here.
I'm used to the older view. Where is that?
Don't you just want to bring this up because that'll give you the list
here? I'm sorry?
Don't you just want to bring this up so that'll just give you the list on the left of what the release definition is?
Yeah. Okay. All right. So if you look at here, we have the different tasks defined for the overall release, right? For example, you're deploying the different components, the multiple components through the PowerShell commands, right? And then what you have is, once you deploy that, you'll get the connection strings. You take the output of that, and then you feed that into another PowerShell, which you can use to configure the, let's say, app settings, right? So for example, Event Hub we might be deploying as a component. We get that as an output from the overall ARM template. When it executes, and use that in a PowerShell command, and then apply the setting in a, let's say, a function app. That way, once you define these as the tasks, then you you deploy, you configure, and then you run a couple of tests after you have deployed it. So that kind of gives you a continuous integration and continuous deployment. So once the first time, obviously, you might take time, but once it is done, then it's pretty seamless, and you can kind of copy this across multiple services. You know, once you're pretty much comfortable with that.
Yeah, so the question was, do you use this as well, like if you want to go create out a test environment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we can use the exact same scripts. It's just that what's really changing is, unless some specific variables that you're defining over here with respect to environment-specific variables, those are the only things that would really change. Rest all the with respect to how it gets these connection strings, everything is the same.
Okay. So I'm going to cut you off, but I do expect you up at the mic again in another couple seconds. So seen everything. Now, there's a couple things that you can follow on from this. Sweet. Am I still good presenting? Did I hit the wrong button?
Awesome.
Oh, no, yeah. I'm just a... Wait, no, seven, six, hit six for me. Okay, there's a couple call to actions here. So go to this URL. It's aka.mswack brk2110. That's this session code. It's going to take you to this page. So Hari's team has done each of the different pieces that you've seen in this have roughly 10 to 30 minute videos going in depth on this. So essentially like your introduction architecture overview, this averaging event hubs and Azure functions, that's 30 minutes of walking through the functions to enrich telemetry from event hubs, going and grabbing stuff from different data sources, hooking it into the custom events, and then pushing it to App Insights. Next video is, hey, how do you actually use that custom stuff in Kusto projections and App Insights to go give you really nice rich stuff? Next one is, how is the team actually going and using log analytics to build dashboards across everything? So aka.mswagbrk2110. There's also right here, there's a nice tutorial from the Azure Docs team that walks you through that whole top layer. So soup to nuts, how do I go create an AAD tenant? How do I go create AAD apps? How do I go create an APIM? Products, apps, go create a traffic manager, everything soup to nuts on how to do this for nice and demos. There's a couple other sessions that I think are extremely valuable that are also in this slide back here. So please go to that. Like I said earlier, you want the URL? Okay. You good? You got it yet? Okay. Like I said earlier, our chief digital officer who reports directly to Satya, Kurt Dalbeny, is talking tomorrow, and he's going to talk for 75 minutes on what we've gone through. For example, in what you would classically call IT, at one point we had roughly 44,000 servers on premise a couple years ago. We are like 98 or 99% in the cloud today. We actually spend a little over $5 million a month on Azure to run our live and business applications for IT, over 700 Azure subscriptions. And so this session that you see here, that this one right here, you can see it's in about 20 minutes, so it's in your I want to go have a drink slot. Go to Expo Theater 1. This gentleman right here is going to talk about that. So how do we actually deal and manage when you hit Azure at scale? How do you do compliance governance across it, but still get out of the way of dev teams so they can go provision stuff and be compliant while they do it.
I think one more session I would like to call out is what you saw, the change feed. So we're getting the change feed into Cosmos DB graph. So I think there's a session at 3 o'clock tomorrow by one of my team members. So you can probably watch that if you're interested from a Cosmos graph standpoint.
And then if you went to the earlier one at 1 o'clock today, that was from one of our devs that figured out how do we do secure app development in the cloud. Is Robert, are you even here still? Okay, so that gentleman in the back is doing one tomorrow, rebuilding for the cloud, reinventing revenue reporting. So the gentleman way in the back, if you want to talk to him about how do we do big data at Microsoft, and how do we have a lot of terabytes in stuff of data in the cloud and how we've redone that, I highly suggest doing that one tomorrow. And then obviously the Kurt Dalbeny talk tomorrow. So there's your URL again. I'm actually part of the IT showcase at Microsoft, so. Here's the last call out, I will say, two more call outs. One, visit the IT Coach Showcase. There's a lot of case studies there on how we've migrated to the cloud. We actually just finished migrating our core SAP instance for Microsoft into Azure IaaS. So our full Azure production footprint, including the backend SQL Server, runs in Azure. We run one instance of SAP for all of Microsoft, and it's in the cloud. So there's some really cool stuff there. You can follow Hari or I. You can feel free to send me a direct email. My ask for you is, out of all the stuff that we've done in IT, out of the hundreds of line of business apps we run, all of those kind of questions that you would want to ask us, please just send me a tweet. So go ahead and tweet me, say, how do you do X, Y, Z yourselves? We'll get the answer and we'll put it out. So that guy, you can get up to the mic now.
For this solution, do you need anything secret inside that we don't see or will not see because you have a
is there anything what?
Have anything customized for your own internal stuff?
No. So we're not using any special sauce, any secret Microsoft internally only stuff.
I mean, obviously the MSI feature is in public preview. That's the only thing that is, I think, not GA yet.
And for our IT, essentially if it's public preview, we basically consider it prod and we just go use it. we're fairly risk loving.
I do have a question on the
architecture,
the diagram, whatever you have. So you have used the JWT token, right? So
can you get just a little closer, just so I get it on the camera?
So you explained the usage of JWT token up to that API layer, but you have function app, right? So I don't know whether the function app is running within the private cloud or on the public, right? So how do you authenticate that layer? How do you make that layer secure? Because that's the one thing we are trying to figure it out. Because most of our migration to Azure, more or less the same architecture, but it's just the function apps. We don't know how to make it secure, if you are in the public. So.
And that's where we are using the managed service identity now. So we are keeping all the connection string and all the secrets really in Key Vault, right? So for example, an AD token to call a particular service, right? So the function app, for example, is a background processor. So the function app effectively using the Key Vault helper that we saw to using managed service identity gets the keys that are there in the Key Vault and makes the connection using AD or shared access key, whichever key that is it needs to call to a particular service.
Okay, but
are you asking more like, okay, so I think where your head is. So
the function apps, the last one, right?
Yeah,
so that's a publicly
So if you were to take this function app and put it up here, is that kind of what you're looking
That's at? What I am. See, you have this, the gateway, right? So that prevents somebody,
from accessing
the SQL injection, whatever, like DDoS attack. You're trying to prevent that layer. But you have this function apps, which is a publicly accessible, URL endpoint. So how do you prevent this DDoS attack and SQL injection? Okay. How do you are managing
so
that?
So you guys, you're not actually sending a caller direct from traffic manager to a function
not
app.
From
you're
there,
sending
yeah.
people, so but what they're doing is they're sending people to API apps, and then that puts essentially the request message into the service bus queue, and then they have the internal functions that are processing off of event hubs. So they're not actually letting people go right from here to talk to the function?
I got that point.
I think his point is it's still on the internet is what this question is.
It's still on the internet. So,
one way to do it is you can create a VNet.
What is that?
You can create a VNet. And so if especially your function app is running in a app service plan, the app service plan can be part of the VNet.
So yeah, that's correct. Okay. So we can have that function apps within the VNet, right?
Yes.
So you can have within the VNet.
Uh-huh.
So are you saying within the VNet or within like an ACE kind of environment and put within the ACE app service environment? Which one are you talking about? Just put that within the VNet?
If it is running on the app service, you can put on the ACE basically. Right? And if it's running in a consumption model, you don't have to worry really. That is really guaranteed by the Azure itself. You don't have to really bother about that.
Okay.
Whether it's logic apps or function apps, it's running in consumption model.
Okay.
You really need not bother about that. Sorry.
One more question. So on the analytics, right?
What?
So you have the analytics.
So apparently this gentleman down here, there was a session that went right before this, PeerSec, where they were talking about some.
No, I saw that, in the previous one, but I don't know whether there's a cost to it. I don't know whether it's coming for free. So there's a lot of things. Yeah. I just want to see what Azure provides. So because we are on the Azure platform, so we don't want to go to third party to buy something.
So you guys are putting it in a VNet.
Mm-hmm. If it is app service plan, effectively.
Yeah.
Okay. But if it's consumption model, in that case, the product takes care of it.
Okay.
There you go.
Can you repeat that?
Yeah. So, basically, Azure function, they provide a property called enable web page or something. That one, if you disable that, it will disable all the web API. So you are not able to browse it at all. So in that case, it's not able to do a DDoS attack. So in that case, the only input for this one will be a service bus, which is encrypted in our Key Vault. So in that case, other people were not able to access function app. Only route will be service bus. That's what happens for how you can protect the DDoS.
So
Wei here is one of the devs on the team, so I would say follow up with him.
Okay, I have one more question on the analytics, right?
You want to go?
So I might have a quick one. So we're very interested in using a lot of the kind of the glue services, Service Bus, Hubs, Event Grid. And I'm particularly interested in the error handling aspect of it, error management. So, you know, dead letter queues, retries, you know, eventually, you know, you got the exponential back off. But what tools do you use to help stay on top of all of that?
Just come on up. So that way you're on this side of the speaker.
Thanks. Actually, that's one section we are not putting here. So there's one thing called queued off certain time. So that one will help you a lot for retry scenario. Because what happens right now for Service Bus, when you abandon the message, it kind of immediately come back to a Service Bus queue. Right? That's a problem we are having as well. But what we have make it, we have a property called queue off certain time. That property will help you in queue after certain time. You can configure your time. As well, you can even specify the exception. For example, what we are doing is, in case of we are not able to submit to SAP, we catch that exception and configure that for delay for a certain time. For some of the retriable exception, we actually catch that exception as well, and we configure that in a different way. So another use case is actually, for example, you know the downstream system is doing the maintaining, right? You don't want to queue at certain time. Now this property will help you as well. For example, you can make it queue after certain time. So at this time, it will retry only after this retry. Not only after this time, you will try to queue back to the Service Bus. So in that case, you avoid the duplicate retry. You avoid the poison message. That's something we have done already in some of the. We saw the pain point for day later, abandon all these things. That's why we utilize that property and trying to avoid this kind of problem.
And can you just repeat what the property was again?
UTC queue time, something like that. Property. That's one property. In queue UTC queue time. You can find it.
Well, good way. Thank you. Thank you.
Two quick questions. One, is there a reason why you use Service Bus as opposed to Event Grid?
I'm getting feedback in here, so it's hard to get.
Is there a reason? There we go.
No, it's the speakers back there.
Oh, okay. Is there a reason why you used Service Bus rather than Event Grid?
Yeah. Is there a reason you use? So, I think the main reason why the team used Service Bus versus Event Grid. This has been running in production for a while. Event Grid.
Oh, okay.
So this has been running in production for a while, right?
Yeah. So
there are definitely scenarios in here where.
No, let me answer this. So the main question, the main reason is, so Event Grid we are also using. That is more for a kind of a CQRS pattern or a webhook pattern. However, Service Bus is something that we're using for transaction management, right? For example, I want to send to a particular transaction to SAP, right? Which might not have that much throughput, right? We want to make sure that we put a peak lock and then keep the transaction management within the Service Bus itself. That way we are kind of giving guaranteed delivery. Gotcha. That's why we are using Service Bus. And I think of all the ones, Service Bus really rocks from that standpoint.
Yeah. I think there are other options in here, like for the team could look at, hey, once the blob hits blob storage, you could have Event Grid fire off.
Yep.
Or I think, you know, you're already in Service Bus at that point. You've already got the metadata in that queue. So like anything with Azure, there are like 10 different ways to do it. Kind of depends on where you're at in your maturity curve and in what time you started. And then you start kind of upgrading as you go.
And can you elaborate on the event log coming out of Cosmos DB and how that interacts with functions? Is that like a trigger in functions for reading from that?
So you're talking about the change feed.
Yeah, yeah.
So change feed, so is your question in terms of how it's configured?
Kind of like expand. Yeah, expand.
I'm just curious how it works.
Oh, so there are two options, right? One is a change feed that the kind of out of box from a function switch you can do. What it does is it kind of scans across all the partitions in that collection and then generates that particular change feed event. And that event is kind of, you know, your function app gets. right? And from there, you can do whatever you want. That's one way to do it. Other way is the SQL SDK, which is a custom code. You write it, and then you kind of write a timer and do the kind of same seek for a particular collection and or multiple collections, and then send it to a subscriber.
All right.
That's right. So,
it's based on the last updated tape, so essentially looking for what's changed since I last.
That's right. Totally. So we, in fact, have that. So pretty much Bistock maps are all XSLT at the end of the day. So you can, if you're OK to, from a maintenance standpoint, still have it in that particular way. Then if you're generating an out-of-box XSLT, let's say you're done a mapping through through the UI instead of writing a external XSLT, when you generate that XSLT, it's going to be pretty little bit messy, though. Right, from a maintenance standpoint, you might not want to do it. But if you're already using external XSLT, that makes it very simple to just call it within Logic App, putting an integration account, the map, and then call it out. So it depends on how you're already in your existing system.
So if people are using Mapper today and they didn't roll custom XSLT, are you surfacing it via Logic App?
In Logic App, you can use the same map, whatever you have within the Bistock. Yeah. And that's how we kind of pretty much migrated. One good thing we previously had is majority, we had already had it as external XSLT, so it was easier to kind of migrate and have a good maintenance as well.
Got some more questions. Is there a session here? Okay, I think we're good to go over a little bit.
Yeah, I noticed in your deployment template for NVSTS, you release a lot of things, create like resource groups and such in Azure. So is that something you do for every single deployment? You're recreating all that stuff, then somehow dropping it again later? Or is that a one-time pass?
I'm going to pre-answer, and then I'll let you answer what you guys are doing. What I've noticed is, because there are dozens of application teams in core services engineering, the ones that are like really, really, really advanced on that, essentially what they'll do is they'll have, if you go to the Azure blog and search for my name, you'll see a blog on there on how we do subscriptions and resource groups within those subscriptions, and also the guy, Robert Venable, tomorrow is a good person to ask on this. Some of our teams, essentially, they'll have like a resource group where they will put their production data stuff, so their production blobs or production SQL databases, all the data components. And then when they do CI/CD releases at night, their VSTS RAM will actually just go create a new resource group, go hook up all the things in there, and then blow away the old resource group. So some of our teams will literally nuke their production compute on a nightly basis and spin up new compute and then just attach it to the production storage.
How do you deal with any kind of downtime? If you are in like a zero downtime?
Yeah, there's always fun stuff like that.
I think we'll talk to, so you're talking about availability effectively.
Yeah.
So what we're doing is we are going beyond the fact that Azure obviously gives a pretty high availability. However, we're going beyond the fact that, hey, for example, service bus. So if it's not able to write to a primary service bus, we write it to a secondary service bus. Okay. And in case of blob, what we're doing is blob is kind of gives a 99.99 RAGRS. However, we kind of went beyond that and put another blob in another region. And we're doing a kind of writes in both, as well as when you're reading it, if it is not found in one particular region, we read it from the other. So that way, it's kind of giving us a pretty much almost like 6 nines, which is equal to probably 6 seconds downtime in a year, which is pretty less.
But then you're paying for a slightly lower SLA, but you've got a little more engineering code in there.
Yeah, and it depends exactly where you are putting that as well.
Yeah.
Whether in the background, and it's we didn't find much impact from a perspective of performance either.
Thank you.
I have a few questions. So you are 100% migrated off of Bistock. Are you still running?
For his stuff.
Yeah.
For your stuff.
I would say around 70% is where we are currently. We are still having some integration from the Azure to Bistock as well.
So when you migrate, can you migrate application from Bistock to Logic App, or do you have to totally redesign application?
Except for the maps. Maps is pretty much, it's usable. But if it comes to orchestrations, you have to do it from the scratch on the Logic app.
So essentially what you guys, like, where you have integration with like SAP, or you have that long running transactional stuff that might span days, and it's really a high correlation. Because in functions, you can do durable now. So you can have a function that runs for days, weeks, months. But where you have that high degree of correlation where, you know, you're used to BizTalk and having like the nice diagrams and everything.
And you can
Logic
apps along with, let's say, Service Bus can do all the pretty much the patterns that you have in BizTalk, whether it is a scattered and gather pattern or, let's say, the sequential convoy. All of them pretty much you can do with Service Bus and Logic app.
So all the functionality is supported in is combining Service Bus and Logic App.
That's right. Okay. Yeah.
So now, what's the future of BizTalk?
You'd have to ask the BizTalk product group. I couldn't answer that. But I think what you're going to start seeing, because all the stuff that his team has done here, I'm seeing across other teams in IT, and the customers that I talk to are doing a lot of these same things. I think at some point before too long, you're going to start to see like an Azure Integration Services or something like that, where the product group realizes and product marketing are starting to put these together. Because if you put all these together and then you kind of put some of the band stuff in there, that is integration in the cloud. So I think all the teams are working together quite a bit. They're starting to hook their stuff up to each other quite a bit more, especially with EventGrid really getting in there. The teams that run EventGrid and Service Bus and Event Hubs are getting into everybody's stuff. I think you're going to see some really cool stuff coming from them in the next couple months.
Thank you.
Hi, I've got two questions. One of them is in that first architectural diagram that you had there. Are all the business logic encapsulated as logic apps and functions? Or do you have it scattered around in an API backend as well?
Yeah, where's your business logic at?
So it depends on what you define as business logic, right? So all the get and post kind of capabilities we are keeping on the web API, because we wanted a kind of a sub-second SLA with respect to when we're integrating with the partners. So that part of it is all in the API app, right? And however, with respect to the background processing logic, with respect to which downstream application should it go, or let's say an enrichment service that you want to call, all of that is either in the function apps or logic apps.
So do you kind of make the call, like if it's a high correlation and it's easier for logic apps, you'll go there, but if it's maybe a modern to modern system, you may just go ahead and use functions.
That's right.
It kind of just depends on.
Correct. And we have started to use function apps also in the front end, but that's, we're still trying to, trying to use that in the front end, but majority we are using at the back end process.
Okay. So if you are, say, for example, calling external APIs within your application, would you do that in the Logic app, or would you do that in your API backend at the moment? Let's say if you need, say, like maybe a sub-second response back from your
So Logic app also gives sub-second response depending on how you design it and what connectors are you using. So for example, if you're getting, hey, you know what, I get an HTTP request, and you're giving the response back without doing any other pieces, like calling another services, that gives sub-second as well. However, to understand one thing is Logic app, in order to give the durability with respect to the transaction management, it puts the each and every stage, it kind of persists into block behind the scenes, which means that there is a cost associated with that. So if you are doing an immediate response back, that's pretty fast as an API app. However, if you're doing a workflow and trying to do that, then it might, certainly might not be as performant like the API app, for example.
So my second question is related to the API's management and API backend. So I understand that you probably do the user authorization at the API backend side of things. Would you do the same when it gets down to the functions or logic app level, or would you simply just pass in basically say the user good or anything, just write down?
So kind of like where's your trusted boundary?
Yeah,
so you're basically your functions, let's see if I can go fast enough. When you're here, these, so you're doing the authentication up here.
Correct.
But when you're back here processing, you're kind of in a trusted boundary because you're in your back end processing. So you don't go recheck credentials or anything like that at that point, right?
Yeah. One thing is really we are as I said earlier, like all the credentials and everything we are storing in Key Vault. So all the components within the architecture are accessing pretty much the same. And obviously, yeah, there's a trust system between the components that are backend to depending on what data is coming in the service bus or blob, that's what it processes.
Okay, so would the boundary be just right after the API backend over there?
Yeah, it's kind of like right here. So caller comes in, hits the API apps. At this point, you're hitting the authenticate authorize. You're still checking to make sure they say who they are. Once you've passed that, you've essentially put the message into service bus. You've essentially sent the ACK back to the caller with the payload. And then in the background, the functions and logic apps will actually go pick up stuff from the queues, do the work, put the results back into Cosmos DB. Then at that point, you're either using your custom stuff to actually push it back out to an external customer, or the external customer is coming back in through, you know, through another API call to go grab like their results from Cosmos DB.
All right. Thank you very much.
Was that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd kind of like to follow up on that a little bit. If you did have a scenario where you needed to delegate the identity to a backend system like SAP, how would you go about doing that?
Yeah, how are you doing managing your security into SAP?
Into SAP?
Yeah.
So obviously, again, we are storing all the credentials with respect to the SAP. Let's say we are calling the SAP from the logic app or function app. We're keeping that in the key vault. And from the key vault, we are getting that data and then sending out, you know, configuring, you know, at runtime to the SAP, yeah. For example.
So you're essentially saying your integration service is, you know, here, mm-hmm. or here maybe talking to SAP, but you're never actually passing the user's authentication token and then to be stored to be used later on to go check into SAP.
It depends on the scenario again, right? So in this case, we didn't want a user impersonation per se. Right, we are just trying to get the message from the caller and then process it behind. If you want to do that, obviously, then you need to be kind of connected, especially, you know, you in those kind of situations, you'd keep it a synchronous transaction. Or you want to keep some metadata about the user, which you can pass it in the, you know, persistent storage or the transient storage like service bus to say who is the particular user. Once you authenticate that's the user, then you can, you know, send the metadata of that particular user in that particular service bus or blob or payload.
Are there some scenarios or some documentation that you could refer to?
Yeah, so if you go to the BRK 2110, here's what I would say. And if you go to BRK 2110, there's the walkthrough from the docs team that walks through essentially here. It doesn't talk about this side, but tweet me asking for that, and I'll continuously up that page. I'll go find all of the walkthroughs. And if there's nothing that there's a decent walkthrough on, I'll go grab one of the devs, and we'll just go put up a blog post, throw up a YouTube video actually having them walk through it, and we'll update the page.
Thanks.
Yeah, earlier you mentioned that some of your devs are basically satisfying the ops role now. If you have to have full segregation of duties and you have to have out folks that have access basically to the production environments, regardless of whether we're talking service bus or logic apps, how could you satisfy that?
Yeah, how do you satisfy your segregation of duties and security among the dev team?
Among the dev team itself?
If you have like SOX or GDPR.
Like the developers can't have the ability to change any data in a production environment. So how could you satisfy that?
So for example, we have split the teams based upon the different services, right? And with respect to which team can, you know, we give the authentication, you have the ability in the VSTS to go ahead and configure which particular team has the access to the repository, for example, right? And in yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so there's do they may have
they have access to production too.
Yeah. So his team may have slightly. So what I would say is in the guy Robert Venable tomorrow. So if you go to I'll put this link up on BRK, but if you just go to lyledodge.me and then hit this link, this is how we do subscriptions. in resource groups within our enterprise. And so if you look at this, there's actually a couple nice things in here, but it really talks about, this is how a lot of our teams do stuff. So essentially, if you're a dev in the team, anything that pushes to prod pushes through VST SRM, and it uses a managed service identity to go push. And then teams can JIT in if they need to, but yeah.
So you can actually.
Yeah, so his team's a little different. We're like, they're devs and ops, but we'll have other teams where, like, you know, you guys can't actually go hit production. Like, you guys deploy code through VST SRM. You guys aren't GDPR. I don't think you guys have GDPR.
We are implementing at this point.
You're implementing it right now. Yep. So, like, 2 months?
Yeah, I think so.
So, tweet me in 2 months and ask how they've solved that.
Yeah.
Because I'm curious, I want to see what they've had to do.
Specifically about your question about the production, so obviously all the artifacts are in resource group, so you can control the access control within Azure itself in terms of which particular users or security group can, you know, have the access to deploy it, right? So that we keep on changing based upon, in our case, we do the on-call, so we rotate that access between the team members.
Yeah. But that still leaves you with a team member with standing access to production. Right.
Yeah.
So whoever's on call has standing access to production. Yeah, I'm over. So I think that's really, I'd say, come back, tweet me in a couple months, and I'll do a follow-up story. Letting me know I'm over.
Very useful information here. A couple of questions. On that reference architecture you had, so SAP, you mentioned on Prime. Is it on Prime core network it's running? So how it can see from API management gateway to SAP, I think you had a backend URL that you would configure, right? So security point of view, how secure it is? Because APIM would be running on Azure, right? Which with public IP, with the external, and SAP running on Prime. So I think you mentioned VPN, site-to-site connectivity.
That's right.
But that has limited bandwidth, I think 2 gig per second.
We are using ExpressRoute for
Express.
That. So ExpressRoute, obviously, you can, the EFL, you give it to the APIM, and for the EBL, you connect to the downstream corporate, you know, whichever applications you have, the network that you have.
Okay, so that reference architecture you had, right, the TM component, that's in the middle, right? The Azure TM traffic manager?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
So that would be public IP? Or because Gateway, it's pointing to SAP. I think SAP on Prime, somewhere down right side, right?
Right. So the ATM is really on the, you know, has nothing to do with the background processor. Right.
So you guys are really talking to SAP from this point.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. So there is no link between the front end that we have with respect to what we have in the back end.
So but my question on gateway component, right? Yeah. You had a back end URL. That back end URL was SAP.
Oh, no. It was pointing to this Azure Traffic Manager.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So in APIM, the URL you saw, you can bring it up if you want, is actually the Traffic Manager back end URL.
Okay.
Which is out in public Azure, which then gets routed to either of these, which then goes into to Service Bus. And then the functions and logic apps that are back here could be set up in VNets or over an ExpressRoute circuit, and those will have access to go talk to our internal SAP system.
Okay. The other thing, I like the dashboard you have on APIM. So we had like a proof of concept, and the executive team really wanted to see how much traffic we are getting to the API. There was the administration, right, for the developer portal administration section where you can see the dashboard. Is there any way to define roles that only, like, I don't want them to click regenerate button to create the security key and it would break the connectivity to the backend. So is there a way to define custom group security group, so they can view what activity going on and all that. So is there a way there? And also, we have Okta, which is IDM, and OpenID Connect. So does it support OpenID Connect? I think it supports OAuth 2.0.
OAuth 2.0 is what we are using, yeah.
How about OpenID Connect? So I think my question, two-part questions. Is there a custom security group and OpenID
Connect? Not to cut you off, but to totally cut you off. I'm being told that like they're cutting our video, so I just want to, we'll stay. So, you know.
So.
Yeah, obviously, like, please fill that out. Thank you. They're going to cut the video. Come on up, let's talk.